John Tennell is one of the world's foremost authorities on the economy of Burma, formerly known as Myanmar. In Australia, he's worked as an analyst for the Reserve Bank of Australia and as a professor at Macquarie University. After writing his 2009 book, Fiery Dragons, Banks, Moneylenders and Microfinance in Burma, and doing a series of interviews on the BBC, Sean came to the attention of State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi. In 2015, she invited him to become her economic policy advisor. When I visited Burma in 2017 with a bipartisan parliamentary delegation, everyone there wanted to tell us how proud they were of this Australian who was working at the top levels of their government. Then, in February 2021, Myanmar's democratic government was toppled by a military coup. Sean was imprisoned for 650 days, from February 2021 to November 2022. His incarceration shocked the world and led to a global campaign for his release. Sean tells the story in his new book, An Unlikely Prisoner, How an Eternal Optimist Found Hope in Myanmar's Most Notorious Jail. Sean Tennell, welcome to the Good Life Podcast.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be talking to a fellow economist about these things.
Certainly is. So not many economists focus on Myanmar. How did it pique your interest?
Purely by accident. When I was doing my PhD a century or so ago, I was in a share house and one of the occupants was from Myanmar, or from Burma. Her grandparents were forced to flee in the 60s and the whole family sort of came out in the 1960s to Australia. And she was working on a PhD too. She would get us all interested in Burma, sometimes to protest about a general who might be arriving in Australia, things like that. Then gradually over time, they discovered I was an economist, and this may sound strange to say, that sometimes economists have skills to bring to problems, and it was believed that I might be able to contribute to the Burmese democracy movement by critiquing Burma's economy as it was being undone then by the general. So I started out just doing certain things, and then, yeah, got to the attention of Aung San Suu Kyi, as you mentioned. We developed a sort of rapport, and I ended up then, yeah, just going over there in 2015.
Had you spent a lot of time in the region before that? Were you one of these youngsters who'd backpacked through Southeast Asia?
No, not really. I developed this obsession about Burma, but not really the rest of the region. In fact, I spent most of my time obsessing about England. And Cambridge and London and places like that. So I wasn't sort of an Asia tragic at that point, but I was very much a Burma tragic.
I found Yangon pretty tough going. As a runner, there was almost nowhere to move around. At the time when we visited, they had restricted motorbikes, and so you had cars absolutely everywhere. Just sheer gridlock. The food was fabulous. People were very, very engaging, but it struck me as a hard place to live. What attracted you to the country in particular?
Well, just on that, Andrew, I can only say I agree with you. I mean, I cannot imagine anyone running in Yangon. I think you would face certain death within about 2 minutes. The roads are just terrible, apart from the traffic, you know, so it'd be swallowed up in some giant pothole. Many things attracted me to the place. Its history, above all, and every aspect of that history. I was, you know, fascinated by Burma's own history, but I was also very fascinated by the colonial institutions and that era of British history in Burma, as well as Australia's, actually. So I became fascinated at that. The more I knew Burmese people, the more I fell in love with them collectively, and that I've maintained all the way to the present. And then finally, the location, the physicality of Burma. It's a most extraordinary place, and as reflecting that old colonial heritage and also the country's complete neglect and lack of economic development is that much of that old colonial architecture still exists in Yangon especially. So it's a very attractive place. One of the analogies I often use is that Yangon reminds me of Miss Havisham's wedding cake in Great Expectation. You can see the magnificence of what used to be there, but it's sort of subsiding in on itself. But you can see the glory.
And a friend of mine, David Madden, had set up a social enterprise hub and also an incubator called Pundir. I remember him just talking about the sheer energy and entrepreneurialism that followed that democratic transition, that sense that so many young Burmese with this pent-up energy were creating businesses, creating social enterprises. It must have been a really exciting time to be working in the government.
Oh, it absolutely was. And in fact, I came across Dave and Pandeya, which really stood out as an incubator of, like fintech and all sorts of firms which were emerging in that time. And the whole place felt as if energy had just been released. You know, it had been held back for decades and suddenly people are on the move and thinking and doing things. But just incredible feeling of sort of unlimited possibilities. And so, so it was great to be helping the government out. The only aspect, though, was a little bit negative on that front is that the government was way behind those entrepreneurial kids, and you know, if I may use that expression, because they're much younger than me. So you often felt as if you're the brake on their activities. And in my role as sort of trying to urge economic reform, I was usually with them and trying to push the government on. So it wasn't without tensions on all those fronts as well.
One of the big challenges that you talk about is the banks and the stability of the banks and the concern that there could have been a banking crisis. How did the banking system get so bad?
Well, there were no private banks at all in Myanmar up until the early 1990s. Then they suddenly emerged, but they never emerged from the get-go in a proper way, if I can say that. I mean, they were really just financial, sort of treasure chests of local crony entrepreneurs. In fact, I shouldn't call them entrepreneurs, but just crony businesses. So they were used, just as the vehicle for lots of insider lending. Their original capital, for the most part, came from quite nefarious activities. The people who ran them really didn't know anything about banking. Like that, they were essentially units to deal in favour of various forms. And so, non-performing loans or bad debts were off the scale. And there just really wasn't anything much in the way of proper banking procedures. So these institutions were pretty bad. But they'd grown big enough to be a problem. So, you know, I must have spent many, many sleepless nights worrying about the banks, because I knew that if anything could derail us and the reform effort, a full-scale banking crisis would do it. So always on edge and always knowing that just about every single bank was technically insolvent. So, you know, you really were on edge the entire time and worried whenever you'd get a report of lines outside an ATM or a branch withdrawing money. So, just constantly nervous about the banks.
You talk about the two things that concerned you in that period as being a banking crisis or a military coup. And you sort of hint a little bit in An Unlikely Prisoner about the potential relationship between the two. There's a sense I get reading between the lines that you felt that the cronies were worried about what the democratic government was doing and might indeed have been some of the shadowy forces behind the return of military rule. To what extent do you think that played in?
I think it's an important element. I don't think it's the precise trigger. I think that's much more in the sort of personal circumstances of the new dictator, Min Aung Hlai, and the people around him. I think their considerations of needing to remain in power to avoid retribution over abuses taking place in the country were sort of uppermost, and their potential fall, I think, was uppermost in their minds. But as the general background, I think many powerful elements in Myanmar, including the banks, felt that the reforms were really encroaching upon them. And 2021 was to be a critical year in which some really important bank regulation was going to come in to at last clean up the banks. But it would have involved the bank owners putting a lot more capital, a lot more of their own money into the institution. So there was great reason for them to be nervous about what was ahead.
And throughout this period, you're working with Aung San Suu Kyi, one of the remarkable people of our era, and you had the privilege of working close with somebody who is known to be quite an intensely private person. What's she like?
She is very private. That is certainly true. In some ways, the best description I could have of her is a kindly English schoolmistress. So she is kind. Once you get to know her, you discover her generosity and her warmth and things like that. But there always is that school mistress manner always there, you know. So you've always got to be very correct in your grammar, and just broadly proper, if I could use that expression. So that element is there. To me, it's a very endearing quality, but I think for people who don't know her, and I think there was many of these who found this, it can be a little bit off-putting, a little bit intimidating. But she's a very warm person. Above all, though, she's highly intelligent, you know, who for recreation, even at the height of her power and her work as state councillor and so on, would read French detective novels in French, I hasten to add, just to relax, you know. And for someone with my language abilities, the idea of, you know, of somebody using yet another language to relax in is quite extraordinary. But she certainly lived up, I think, to all of my expectations across that period I worked with her.
One of the most challenging periods, I imagine, before the military coup for you would have been the crackdown that occurred in Rakhine State in August 2017, the mass killings of Rohingya Muslims, the rapes, the murders of children, and then the response from the National League for Democracy people, and particularly Aung San Suu Kyi herself, who not only failed to criticise the military, but also went to the International Court of Justice to argue against the genocide allegations that were being made against the military. How did that test you and your relationship with her over that period? You must have wanted to do a lot of good, but at the same time, I imagine you would have felt, perhaps I should just walk away and resign.
Yeah. Absolutely, Andrew, it was the most testing thing and probably the worst time of all. And I'm not even sure that it wasn't worse than the later imprisonment. It was really awful because, of course, as you mentioned earlier, I'd gone to Burma in order to help out the democracy movement, which had at last got into government. We were going to do things, turn Myanmar around, all that sort of thing. And to be confronted and be in a situation where you're with a government in which genocide is taking place. Now, I would argue it was not taking place by the civilian government, but nonetheless, the military attached to them was doing all these things. Terrible moral dilemma, and I faced exactly the decision you mentioned about, is it time just to go? Because I thought, you know, I got into this to do good, and the idea of being in any way sort of an apologist for atrocities and things like that, and I was above all concerned never to justify anything, particularly not in economic terms, never to say, oh, well, you know, you can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs, and, you know, some of those awful sort of lines we've heard down through history. So, and it involved a lot of self-questioning. I thought, you know, if I'm staying, am I doing this for reasons of self-glorification, or I like the position and all that. So, yeah, it led to a lot of dark nights of the soul, I think is the expression, of working out what to do. In the end, I did decide to stay because I thought we could do more on the inside, particularly perhaps using economics to try and bring about change. And one of the things we did do, and with Dorsu's permission, was to try to come up with an economic way of making things a bit better in Rakhine, of highlighting what was going on. We even designed some internal sanctions that could have been levelled against military officers causing the atrocities in Rakhine State. And we were going to use international mechanisms to sanction these people, but use the intelligence that we had by being in country to do that. Now, I'm not sure that it would make much of a difference, to be honest, so I don't want to exaggerate the efficacy of that in the end. I don't think it would have stopped anything, but it would have been something to do. But likewise, just to be there and to put an alternative voice to Dorsu, because I think one of the awful things about the whole story of the Rohingya and in Rakhine and so on was that many wonderful Burmese people in so many other ways would be arguing not so much against Rohingya, but in a sense attempting to justify in various ways what was happening. Part of the thing I felt a responsibility to do, but it certainly wasn't pleasant, was to argue and put alternative things to friends of mine and say to them, look, you know, you're a deeply courageous person. I've admired everything you've done for decades. You've many of them were political prisoners and all that, and say, look, you know, just pull back a bit and see what's going on here. So we tried to do all of that, but yeah, but it certainly wasn't easy.
Yes, there doesn't seem... One of the things that struck me visiting Myanmar was there didn't seem to be any pride in the country's multiculturalism among even progressive Burmese. There seemed to be that sense from the NLD people that it was a Burma first kind of country. But why do you think that Aung San Suu Kyi made that mistake?
I think it was political calculation. One of the things of being around her for such a long time was that I believe deep down that she doesn't have any sort of racist sentiments or any sort of hostility to anyone of any other religious background. I think her mind is devoid of anything like that. But I think she did make a political calculation of how she could handle the military. So we mentioned at the beginning that the military were always poised there potentially to come in and take over. And so there was a number of things that she needed to do to keep them on side, if you like. And I think part of the calculation was to keep the military in her debt and in that way have some leverage over them. Now, I do think that was a major miscalculation. And I think, above all, her appearance at the International Criminal Court, etc., to, in a sense, defend the military. I think she played a very careful game with her words, but how it was perceived outside, and rightly so, was in defence of the military. But again, as I say, I think it was a calculation based on, having some sort of leverage over the situation. And again, I know in the background there were all sorts of things she was trying to do to sort of pull the military off, but it was a miscalculation, as clearly demonstrated by the results. So I don't think it was a moral failure so much as it was a failure of judgment, in my view.
So let's talk about your becoming an unlikely prisoner. In February 2001, the military coup took place. How did you find yourself behind bars? Tell us about the events that led up to your incarceration.
So it all came fairly suddenly, of course, straight after the coup. I was there in a hotel and got an email very early one morning. In fact, it was the morning that I was due to go back up to Naypyidaw, the capital city of Myanmar, to meet up with Dor Suu again and to plan the second term of her government. So she'd just been re-elected. We were going to do much bolder economic reform. So we're all set to do that. And then on Monday, the 1st of February, the military coup took place. There'd been some warning before, but there'd been rumours of coups all the time. Mm. So this seemed to be a more plausible set of rumours than hitherto. But nonetheless, right up to the end, I didn't really believe the rumours. I thought that there would be a last-minute pushback. I think from Dor Suu, I think she had calculated that there would be, you know, a last-minute pullback of the military from actually going ahead. But, yeah, there wasn't, and took place on the 1st of February. I then faced an agonising few days about what to do, about how to get out of the country, because I was getting all sorts of warnings from different embassies around the place that the military would come for me. At first, I didn't want to believe it. I thought that my position as a fairly prominent foreigner would mean that they would leave me alone. Also, in that early stage of the coup, the regime were anxious to give the impression internationally that it was business as usual. Mm. And in fact, they sort of tried to get the message across that, you know, we're not going to be a messy democracy, but we're going to be better in economics. We're going to be disciplined and, you know, and held up examples like China and Vietnam and things like that. So I thought I'd be safe because I thought, you know, if they arrested me, that would send a terrible signal. As it turned out, they don't care about terrible signals, and mine was the least important, you know. So then on the 6th of February, they arrested me in this hotel and took me off to a police station, then ultimately to the prison.
And the initial place you were held, you describe as the box, a sort of shipping container with a metal chair bolted to the middle of it. How did you find your first experience of being in there? How did you manage to pass your days?
So I think the first impression was one of horror, but also complete disassociation. And I'm sure people who are listening to this will know the sort of feeling when some terrible event happens to you in life. It might be a relative dying or something like that. And you have that initial feeling you don't believe it. Like, it just doesn't seem real. So for me, there was a bit of that, like complete horror and fear, anxiety, all of that. But yeah, disassociation as well. So that was the initial thing. But then I had to cope with it, being pushed into this box. And I think my initial reaction was just to pace up and down. Like an animal at the zoo. I think that's what we all do. And you get some sort of agency back, you know, because you're doing something and you're being physically active. And I think that, you know, that makes you feel better anyway and helps you deal with the anxiety. You know, I count my steps and all of that. The novelty of that wore off, though, pretty quickly. So then I would invent stories and games. And so I tried to remember all sorts of strange things, episodes of history. I tried to remember all the US presidents in chronological order, all the US states, all the Australian prime ministers, all the kings of England, all that sort of stuff. And success in most of those areas after a long period of time. Some I had failures. I never did get those early kings and queens of England. But the others, I think I got through.
And you talk about the focus on small details in this period, the little paint chips on the wall, the little drawing someone had done of Spider-Man inside your cell. The small must loom very large when your world is contracted to a shipping container.
Absolutely. And the box was devoid of sort of any sort of notable thing, you know. It was just and so anything would sort of grab your attention, and you would see patterns in things. And in the book I described some paint splashes on the ground, and they were red, white and black, and I was sure one of them, I could imagine it sort of looked like David Beckham kicking a goal for Manchester United. But I think we all do that, right? You know, when you're at the doctor's surgery or the dentist's waiting room or something, and you start to see patterns in the wall, in the wallpaper, stuff like that. So yeah, but it was a way that my imagination kicked in, and I could imagine things and stories.
And where were you taken next?
Then I was taken, so I spent 2 months in the box and in complete isolation throughout all of that. Then I was taken off to Yangon's infamous insane prison. So it's spelled I-N-S-E-I-N, but insane is the name, and it pretty describes the place. So old colonial jail built to the model of the philosopher Jeremy Bentham, so a panopticon, a big sort of wagon wheel structure with a giant tower in the middle and the cells and wards of cells leading off that centre spoke sort of thing. And so from the tower you could see everything. Built in about the 1890s, really run down, horrible sort of place. It just reminded me so much of places like Port Arthur or Fort Denison here in Sydney Harbour. That's what it was like. And everything was like that. All the accoutrements, the handcuffs, the chains, they're all clanking sort of convict chains. Just a horrific place. And the guardhouse, just this imposing, horrible looking structure sort of frowning down on you as you're being prepared to be pushed in and its giant doors. So yeah, just a pretty awful place, but as it turned out, it was much better than the box.
You, of course, in Southeast Asia too, and so you've got heat and plenty of insects.
Oh, exactly, Andrew. So the temperatures are just awful. I'm cognizant of right now in Yangon, it's about 45 degrees, but that's the sort of temperature I was looking at the time. So impossibly hot and humid. And the usual insects, ants and spiders and rats, but some real horrors that I've never seen in Australia. These giant centipedes that would have been a foot long would come in, and the other prisoners told me that these are poisonous and I had to watch out for them, and particularly because they had a very unnerving tendency to get in the toilet. And so that was horrific. And then most horrific of all, scorpions. I've never seen a scorpion in my life, and these things were, probably about 6 inches long. These big black scorpions with the arch tail with the sort of spike on it. It was just horrific, and you know, unhelpfully, the other prisoners also told me that they often get in your bedding. Just awful.
How was the food?
Dreadful. So not inconsistent with the insects. No, really awful. The food was served in buckets. It was sort of like a very badly boiled rice bucket, another bucket of some sort of gram, some sort of like lentil sort of thing. That was probably the healthiest thing. And then another bucket that had meat of some description or fish, but any goodness, any sort of flesh on it, anything worth eating was entirely stripped bare by the time it got to the prisoners. And so, yeah, it was often just sort of bones and oil in the bottom of the bucket. It was just horrible. So I avoided that as much as possible. So, yeah, the food was awful. And not unsurprisingly, I then lost about 20% of my body weight over the period I was in prison.
You got down to 45 kilograms, I think you say in the book.
That's right, yeah, yeah. I sort of wanted to lose a little bit of weight before I'd entered the prison, but not that much.
and the food mucked up your teeth too, I understand.
Yeah, so the teeth, I think, are the one thing that you just don't think of in sort of prison narratives. But, your teeth get into trouble very quickly. So in the rice that I mentioned, you'd often find all sorts of impurities, basically little small stones or was probably bits of metal actually off the cooking pots would be amongst the rice. And so you'd bite down on them, and I broke both of my front teeth biting down on these little impurities. But then, of course, you can't really wash your teeth properly. The water's really dirty and you know, it's just, yeah, any sort of dental hygiene is almost impossible. And then, of course, if you do get a toothache, it just becomes unbearable and you can't think of anything else. I mean, I'm a total coward when it comes to dental procedures of any form anywhere. But in the prison, yeah, it just was so miserable on that front. You could almost think of nothing else but your teeth.
One of the things you speak about in the time during incarceration is that steadily you were allowed access to more books. How did books change your experience of being in prison?
Yeah, absolutely, completely. Andrew, I've always had a horror in my life, and so I think in this way somehow fate prepared me for this, because I always had a horror of being anywhere without a book. And here I was, and I used to think about how would I cope. Anyway, so I did get through it, but it was still awful. So when the books did arrive, it was absolutely transformational. And the books came through the Australian Embassy, through my wife and through some wonderful friends who remained in Myanmar for me. And so I got a steady chain of books, such that in the end, I got about, I think it was 137 books delivered to me. And every one of them I would have read minimum of three times, some of them about 10. So I became very, very familiar with some of those books, and they become my dearest possessions. And even now, you know, I see the cover of one of the books I had in the prison, and I just get sort of a flood of emotion in seeing it.
And you seem to span the gamut from spy novels through to Ben Bernanke's autobiography. How did those different books keep you going in different ways?
Yeah, so I think probably like everyone, there are times when you want to read certain books and other times you want to read something else. So I really hankered for big intellectual biographies and histories, things like that. So I had the Robert Skidelsky single volume biography of Keynes, for instance, and that
fabulous
was
book.
That was wonderful. But then sometimes you'd want a blessed relief, so you'd have a Len Deighton spy book or something like that. Although in an act of wonderful, wonderful madness, my sister Lisa Brandt sent me some Famous Five books of Enid Blyton, which the incongruity of it was just wonderful. Yeah, so a real mix of books, but yeah, big intellectual biographies. Particularly if they were about economists, just, yeah, totally were what I wanted.
The thing that always strikes me about Famous Five, Sean, is the way that it's written just in that era after post-war rationing has ended. So much of Famous Five is to do with food, you know, the lashings of orange aid and the like. I imagine that might have been quite hard to read about in prison.
Yeah, there were moments, if you didn't have food, it was just awful, reading about great hams and tongues and boiled eggs and all this sort of stuff. Because you're right, I mean, Enid Blyton's description of food is sort of Nordic and Viking-like.
Yes.
Right? And it's feasting. So, yes.
In some sense, An Unlikely Prisoner is an extended love letter to Havu. It's just, I'm really struck reading it, the depth of your connection with one another, and particularly the thoughtful way in which she engaged in your irregular conversations, thinking about what it was that she could best say in order to buoy up your spirits and leave you feeling more optimistic. What did she do through those conversations that made a difference to you?
So I think it was mostly in knowing me. So she would shelter me sometimes from things, but not too much, because I think she also recognised that if I thought she wasn't telling me the truth, that would be a problem. As it turned out, there were some things that she kept from me, but I never had any perception of that. So a feeling of sort of frankness, I think, was one of the most important things. Likewise, she was the person choosing the books. So she knew me and was able to, you know, help me in that way. But then, yeah, just to keep my spirit uplifted, if you like, she would talk to me about, you know, Formula One motor racing and where things were on that, as well as some of the intellectual stuff, because, you know, she's a fellow economist and interested in things like, you know, monetary thought and all that. Mm. And, of course, this is while I was in there, there was the great flowering of Bitcoin and modern monetary theory and all that. So we would literally spend some of the precious minutes of conversation talking about things like that. But it helped me because it made me feel connected to the world. And then I suppose the other really important thing was that she was the conduit for what was going on outside. And so through her testimony, I knew that Australia was right in behind me, that there were like literally millions of people sort of following the story. And that made me feel, you know, except for occasions where I, you know, completely lost it and sort of despaired and so on. But for the most part, I never felt alone the whole time. I just knew so many people were rooting for me. And I think that came through what she was able to tell me.
The reader is left in no doubt that you're both economists when you explain why her name for you was the liability. Why is that?
Well, so yeah, it's a riff on both the fact that we're economists and we often, both of us are taught monetary economics as well. So yeah, the whole idea of there are assets and there are liabilities, but it's also a little bit of an in-joke because we loved watching the Bourne films. And of course, in the Bourne films, famously, the people like Jason Bourne are always called the asset. And so I used to always call me the liability. And it certainly turned out to be true.
And then you even write her a love poem at one stage in which you draw an analogy with economic bonds too.
I do. And in fact, I've got that in the book. And yeah, it's a perfect example, I'm afraid, of my just appalling judgment when it comes to poems as a literary device, I think.
I remember when I was a kid, my father, Michael Lee, who was an academic working in Indonesia, we were living in Jakarta at the time, and he wanted to go along and see some political prisoners in Sipinang prison, and for some reason decided that taking his eldest son, I was then 8 years old, would be a good idea. So I got to visit this notorious prison in the Suharto era, and was really struck at the time by the way in which, in order to survive, you just had to strictly comply with absolutely everything. So there was a gap separating the political prisoners from everyone else. Nothing stopped them stepping across that gap except the knowledge that if they did, they would be badly beaten. How did you... did you feel as though that same atmosphere of fear... of violence pervaded the imprisonment experience for you and for other political prisoners?
Yeah, and I think unquestioned obedience to orders seriously given was just the norm. Like you just knew that you had to do that. There was a little bit of flexibility around that, and being a political prisoner was odd in that there were some things, some privileges you didn't have, actually. So funnily enough, regular prisoners had much greater access to the outside world, were able to trade much easier with each other, swap things, have much greater mobility. We were much less visible to the guards, where we were very closely watched all the time. Having said that, though, it also meant that some of the prison guards, many of whom were very poor themselves and had no particular liking for the military regime at all, so you would find sympathetic guards to you as well, and a certain degree of respect. which I think wasn't there for the ordinary criminals, even though at various times they were able to do more things than we were. So, yeah, an interesting element that. When I was up in the prison in Naypyidaw in the capital, I think the proximity of the generals meant that as a political prisoner and really prominent ones, we were sort of more ill-treated there in the sense that the rules around us, the restrictions around us were much more binding than they were anywhere else, because I think the prison guards were always worried that the generals would come, and they often did actually, would come and inspect what was going on.
Mm.
And the guards would get into trouble if they weren't treating us strictly enough. But that all pervasive, I guess, feeling that you don't transgress the rules, yeah, sort of an assumption from the outset.
Was it in Naypyidaw that you and the NLD leaders set up Barbed Wire University?
Sure was. So every afternoon after lunch, we were allowed for 2 hours outside, and we would sit in a drainage ditch just outside the cells, and we came up with Barbed Wire University, where I'm proud to say that economics was the major topic of discussion, much to the boredom and frustration of some of the other political prisoners. But the finance minister, the deputy finance minister, the deputy head of the central bank, we loved it. And we would talk about monetary policy. We'd talk, I mean, it seems crazy now, we'd talk about all the things that we could do now to fix things as soon as the military got out of the way. And, you know, a couple of hours would go by and you'd sort of forget where you were. You felt like as if you were in some sort of academic seminar by the time the 2 hours were up.
With the who's who of the National League for Democracy. That's
absolutely. And these people intellectually were just first rate, you know. And, and it was great. There was no topic we couldn't talk about. And we'd go into philosophy and religion and politics and history, all sorts of things. But, but economics for me was the sort of takeaway.
One of the things that struck me about your accounts at prison was you talk about the high degree of tolerance for gay prisoners and also for Muslims, and you talk about King Mong Shui and particularly how he was respected by other prisoners. What do you put that down to? You know, one might have thought that under conditions of deprivation, prejudices would rise rather than fall.
I think, Andrew, it's an interesting question, that one. I think it's partly because the cohort is self-selecting. So I'm with people, in a sense, who are out there politically fighting against the military. And because they're people like that, they're not just sort of fellow travellers in the democratic experience. You know, they're out there fighting for it. And so for them, I think issues of human rights, of human equality, of simple sort of decency are just part of their makeup. And, so I never saw a single instance of any sort of prejudice against any of the groups, you know, that we're talking about. An incredible degree of coherence and really strong morale. I think that's the other thing. They buoyed each other up. They certainly buoyed me up. And I think there was just a feeling of being in it together. So I think just awfully impressive people. Who were doing what they were almost born to do. I don't know, there was something just innate that just seemed that they didn't fall into easy prejudices or easy venting of frustration. Like, yeah, it was incredibly impressive, more than performance, a way of living through this experience.
A lot of your time in prison was awaiting trial, but eventually you came to trial. What was that trial itself like?
Utterly absurd. Absurd from top to bottom. It was like even bad theatre. Like, it wasn't even good absurdity. But like, beginning with the physicality, the courtroom was this house that had sort of odd boxes stacked around to sort of make it look like a courthouse. And there was a crest that went on the back wall behind the judge, and the crest would keep falling down from the wall and crashing to the ground. And I mean, it was just totally absurd. Witnesses were paraded to give evidence against me. I think 9 out of the 10 witnesses I'd never seen before in my life, and yet they testified that, you know, they'd met me and I'd made all these confessions to them. Ridiculous documents were presented to me that allegedly I'd had access to. I had one particular document presented to me as proof that I'd stolen secrets, because it had top secret written on it. And I told the prosecutors when they presented it to me, I said, look, it's got top secret on it because I put top secret on it. It's my document. And I never forget the response of the prosecutor, which was, doesn't matter who wrote it. You shouldn't have had it and you shouldn't have read it. So,
And you had a little bit of a tension with your fellow defendants between you wanting a quick trial in order that you could then move on to a potential process of pardon, them wanting a slower trial because they knew that the chances of pardon were lower and that they might be in better conditions while awaiting trial and after sentencing. How did that tension play itself out?
Yeah, it was awful. It played out, Andrew, in a sense that they were just incredibly generous and just went along with it. I think, but exactly for the reasons that you've said, that there was no doubt we're going to be found guilty. That they wanted to prolong it a bit longer to get access to lawyers and information from outside and things like that. On the other hand, they knew that my situation was best served by getting the trial over as quickly as possible and then being deported. Now, as it turned out, that calculation never quite worked out anyway, because after being convicted, they then kept me for another 2-3 months. So it never quite worked out how we expected. But, again, it was another sort of illustration of their incredible generosity to me. It was more of a tension actually between my lawyers and their lawyers than it was between us. We only vaguely spoke about the issue, and certainly I never advocated it for that to them. It was sort of a tension in the background. But again, you know, just illustrates the incredible generosity that they displayed to me.
Yeah, I imagine it must have been terribly hard for those who had been incarcerated under the previous military dictatorship, that sense of here we go again and going back into a situation they thought they had left behind forever. How did they hold up? How did Aung San Suu Kyi herself hold up?
Yeah, they held up incredibly well. And, you know, as you mentioned, for me, the idea of going back into prison, I'm sure I couldn't survive that. And yet they did it. Here they were doing exactly that. They displayed no sign of that at all. I never saw the whole time I was there, amongst those prominent political prisoners I was with, none of them break down, even engage in despair or become, you know, unnecessarily depressed. I mean, it was a depressing environment, so, you know, we weren't exactly celebrating. But, just incredibly strong all the way through. I was really astonished by that. I guess, you know, that they had resources that I didn't have, that they were able to meditate and things like that. I tried a bit of that and couldn't do it. I guess, you know, to some extent they were in their own country and they knew the scene and they were able to communicate much better with guards and things like that than I was. But you know, other than those sorts of things, they were in a measurably worse position than I was and yet held themselves up incredibly well. And as I say, they spent a lot of their time helping me. So, nothing but admiration in the way that they reacted.
How did you find out you're going to be released?
It was very sudden. 2-3 months after I was convicted, I was taken back down to insane prison. I was just pacing the cell one morning when a guard suddenly appeared and said, "Good news, Sean, you're going home." And it was just so stunning because I'd spoken to my wife the previous day and we'd realised that I was not going to be released before Christmas. So this is the Christmas of 2022. And that it would be sometime in mid-2023, we thought, before I would be released. So real shock. And the first thing I said to him was, "Please, please tell me you're not kidding." And he said, no, and you've only got 10 minutes, back everything. So I dithered around for about 9 minutes of that 10, and then virtually left with nothing. Except for the elephant made out of coffee bags, which was probably remains the most precious thing I have, physical item I have in my life, because it had been made by other prisoners out of coffee satchels. Sachets, rather. In the form of an elephant, and it's beautiful. Grab that. I did grab a couple of books that I really just could not be parted with. Other than that, then just sort of was taken out of the prison. Spent a frustrating few hours being part of a prisoner cohort, being lectured to by the Minister of Prisons about how important it was to be a good citizen. then before being taken off to Yangon Airport and then ultimately home.
And I remember when I interviewed Terry Waite, the British hostage negotiator who was locked up by Hezbollah for 5 years in Lebanon. He talked to me about the challenge of re-release and the need to slowly re-engage with the broader community. His strategy was he became a fellow of Trinity Hall in Cambridge, where he said pretty much everyone was an introvert, and so he didn't have to take his socialising in large doses, and could steadily work his way back into the world. Did you have a thought as you re-entered that, you know, a bit like those people who've been in POW camps in World War II, you don't want to eat too much lest your stomach explode? Did you have that sense that you needed to ration your socialising and the way in which you re-engaged?
Intellectually, I did. In practice, I didn't. Right. So I thought about doing that. But the tumult of events, my desire to see people, to eat ice cream, to drink a glass of red wine, to watch TV, all of that sort of stuff just came in a rush. So I must admit, I did gorge myself in all of those areas.
Yeah, yeah. And Terry also talked to me about anger and the importance of controlling his anger and not letting it completely overwhelm him. Is that a sense that you had, Sean?
I don't think so. So I think just incredible relief, joy at being home and so on, meant that I maintain an incredible anger towards the regime in Myanmar, but I mean a bit about what they did to me, but even worse, and I think I'm being honest in saying this, even worse with what they've done to the country and the economy, yes. And the, you know, just destroying all the reforms and what they're doing to colleagues. I think that's probably the biggest thing that I have now as a feeling of anger and frustration about, is that many of these wonderful people I've mentioned who saved my life and were so generous and all that remain rotting in prison over there. And so, yeah, I feel very great anger about that. For me, it's sort of just such an extraordinary sort of journey, which I've tried to, rationalise a bit. I think anger's not really there. It comes every now and then, but yeah, I think I've displaced it. In other words, it may come back in different ways, but yeah, displacement by bad economic policies, as much as all the other horrible stuff the regime is doing. That's where I direct it.
And you did anger them enough that the military regime then withdrew your pardon. How does that now affect you?
Yeah, that was the most extraordinary thing, because at the time they withdrew the pardon and cancelled the amnesty and all that and ordered my re-arrest, I hadn't really said that much. I'd really just said, you know, I'd had a terrible time in Myanmar. It was so wonderful to be back. And not really much else. I'd not really gone to town, you know, deconstructing all the things that they did or anything like that. So it came as a real shock to me, actually, because I thought surely they must know that I'm going to talk about what had happened. Yeah, so it was a bit of a shock. At first, I was going to dismiss it. I thought, well, who cares? There they are over there. What can they do to me? Until I found out from Department of Foreign Affairs, well, actually, they could do a lot. You know, they could really crimp our travel and issue arrest warrants through Interpol and, you know, all of this sort of stuff. So, yeah, so it has had an effect, that, which, which we're doing our best to work around. But, and it was, I must admit, I did have some bad moments over that because, late at night I would think, you know, even here in Sydney, that long arm of the dictatorship in Myanmar can reach out to me. And it was a bit unsettling, the thought that they could do that.
Do you want to go back to Myanmar if there's a return to democracy?
I'd love to. Yeah, I would love to. I miss the people. I miss many of the locations that, you know, were just part of my life. In practical ways, I'm not sure if I'll ever be able to, because I think, I've got this arrest warrant sitting over me. It's hard to imagine if there was a complete change politically in Myanmar, a fully democratic government with the military now completely out of politics and not still halfway there as they were in the period that I was there, maybe then. But I think in any other scenario, there'd sort of be an overarching threat, I think, throughout the whole time. Mm. So I worry I'll never be able to go back, but I would love to go back.
Sean, let me close with a couple of questions that I ask all of my interviewees. What advice would you give to your teenage self?
Oh, the teenage self would be... now, how can I say this without engaging in cliche? Because I was about to say to follow your heart and things like that. But to not be afraid, I think. And that really just reflects my own background. And in some ways, this is, you know, reflected in the title of the book, Unlikely Prisoner, because I was the least likely person who would end up in a prison. I was so cautious to a fault as a teenager, as a young person. So, yeah, so the advice, I think, to a younger person or younger self would be, don't be too worried about things. Leave worrying for later. Be a little bit more adventurous and follow where your desires are.
What's something you used to believe but no longer do?
I used to believe, I think, that people were not as generous as I've now discovered them to be. So I've actually had a positive turnaround on that. I was probably a little bit more cynical about individual behaviour before now, or before the experiences, and now that I think, and it's interesting because this is why I think most people would behave at least as well as I did, if not better, because I think they'd probably be more practical, or I hope they would be. The people are fundamentally decent and generous and will display those attributes if given the chance. So I think, yeah, just a change in the way that I think people behave.
It is striking that you can be locked up for 650 days and come out with a sunnier view of human nature. But I really like some of the moments in the book where you talk about the warmth and the character of the common criminals, people who'd been arrested for trafficking and the like.
Absolutely. They were the most generous people in some ways. I remember these drug traffickers who were there from Taiwan, and because they had various money flows into them in the prison, wouldn't dare, you know, work out how they got to be there, that they would have all sorts of food and everything, which they would just liberally share out with people. They were sort of renovating part of the prison to share out. It was, yeah, the most extraordinary thing. And I think I say in the book too, that they were sort of very innocent people, if I can say that. I mean, I've no doubt they were guilty of drug trafficking, but in many ways they were innocent abroad when it came to the world how the world works, I think.
Sean, when are you most happy?
I'm most happy being at home, watching television at night with my wife and daughter, I think, watching some silly miniseries or something. I think that's probably when I'm most happy.
What's the most important thing you do to stay mentally and physically healthy?
I think it remains reading. Reading, which was, you know, something deep laid way back in my youth and all the way to the present. Yeah, so I think, reading is the number one thing.
Do you read differently now? Do you find you read with a greater intensity? Do you read more slowly than you did before your book consumption was rationed?
I think I have a problem of abundance at the moment. I'm actually having a real problem finishing books because I have so much choice now that I tend to go from one to the other. Which is something, you know, that I was always worried that the mobile phone was stimulating. Now I think the experience in the prison it's a smorgasbord of things now for me to look at. And so, yeah, that's a bit of a problem.
Aren't people who finish every book just committing the sunk cost fallacy?
Indeed. I think excessive choice and chopping and changing is probably equally problematic and inefficient.
Do you have any guilty pleasures?
I eat way too much ice cream, particularly late at night, watching these aforementioned TV shows.
You have a bit of ice cream consumption catching up today.
This is true.
And finally, Sean, which person or experience has most shaped your view of living an ethical life?
It's probably the life of a French historian called Marc Bloch, who was an economic historian who was behind the Annales school of sort of economic history in France. He ended up being arrested by the Nazis and ultimately executed. But, his life was a life of incredible integrity and courage. I knew vaguely of him before I was in the prison in a wonderful book written by Clive James called Cultural Amnesia, where Bloch comes out in that. But then I was able to read a little bit more about him. I got my wife to send me some things about him in the prison. And his life, his example, really inspired me.
Sean Tennell, economist and former prisoner, thank you very much for taking the time to share your wisdom on the Good Life podcast today.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Good Life, Andrew Lee in conversation. We appreciate getting feedback on the podcast, so please leave us a rating or tell a friend about the show. We'll be back with another inspiring guest to discuss living a happier, healthier, and more ethical life.